Welcome to the Global Health Perspectives podcast. I'm Evan Hahn, the producer of the podcast, and I'm also the digital and social media specialist at the Foundation for a Smoke-Free World. For the last episode of the year, Derek and I discussed putting together something a little different. We started this podcast in the early days of the pandemic. It was early April, and WHO data suggested that there were over 163,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S., and just under 3,000 deaths. A number that, sadly, seemed like quite a lot back then. But we thought we could use the podcast to help stay connected to some of the leading scientists and influencers and professionals involved in smoking health research. So throughout the podcast you're about to listen to, Derek is going to take you through our journey. You're going to hear me pop in from time to time with clips from some of our past guests. So here's Derek.
The Foundation for a Smoke-Free World felt that we were going to see the intertwining of a massive global pandemic driven by the COVID-19 virus and our own work addressing smoking throughout the year, and that the best way to explain what was happening on the ground would be to have podcasts with experts in the field. And with that in mind, we started a series that continued throughout 2020. Here we give you some of the highlights. At the beginning of the pandemic, I happened to be in Israel working with one of the groups who help us use digital social media to be able to track the untoward effects of e-cigarettes and IQOS on human health. They were showing me in early February that the COVID-19 symptoms were already being picked up around the world, and raising the question that maybe the social media platforms could in fact become a very valuable tool to predict the future course of the pandemic, something which we supported them to work with the Yale School of Medicine to do. And by the end of 2020, the predictions and the predictive power of using social media was actually found to be extremely powerful.
The Israeli analytics tool that Derek is talking about here is a global data aggregator called Signals Analytics. And as Derek said, this is a tool that has the capacity to track digital trends, and that could predict upcoming or ongoing public health emergencies. Here's Shlomi Medar, the VP of Healthcare Solutions at Signals, from episode 3, which originally aired April 7th. And at this time, there were over 333,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the United States.
I wish to briefly mention one of our recent projects. I think you touched upon it a little bit. I will elaborate. It was an analytics platform that was built following the vaping-related lung illness outbreak, what we call the E-Valley. And we built that platform in order to detect early signals of future outbreaks. So you already see the resemblance between the E-Valley, the vaping incident, and the COVID-19 outbreak that we're experiencing. So we figured that consumers will share their daily experiences in social media and online forums for various reasons. For example, they will be seeking advice. They're just, you know, sharing their life experiences. This is something we see a lot, mainly with teenagers and younger people, and it's a great source of information. Our assumption, by the way, our underlying assumption which was later validated, was that this type of data appears online earlier than official authorities' announcements. So it really helps you to foresee those type of outbreaks. Before you even start monitoring and gleaning insights, you can actually get a head start, which is obviously now very apparent that it could save a lot of lives in the process.
Shlomi, I think if you could just mention that is exactly what you saw with the E-Valley outbreak, and maybe just one or two examples of the very early signals before the CDC knew what it was.
Yeah, that's a great point. So actually, when we gleaned, we looked backwards into the data, we were able to track discussions that talk about the use of artificial THC use in vaping as a driver for seizures. So just to remind our listeners, when the E-Valley outbreak was concluded, the culprit was actually something very similar. So it was a synthetic form of vitamin E that was found in CBD and THC vapes. So we were able to track that a year before the outbreak took place. And the point is, if you know how to use data and taxonomy, you can really surface those signals very early on, and for the very least, be prepared for the outbreak once it's at your doorstep.
Yeah, so now maybe talk about how this evolved, and as you started looking forward, you weren't just finding untoward effects possibly of vaping, but of a new respiratory condition.
Exactly. So interestingly, the platform also captured COVID-19 related signals. Again, the vaping platform we're talking about. So we had to somehow adapt the taxonomy. However, and taxonomy, it's a collection, I'll just say to our listeners, it's a collection of terms and synonyms that is being generated both by machine learning and human intelligence in order to stratify, classify, and then analyze the information. Without it, the data will be useless. So we already started off with a very good taxonomy that was generated by a group of our collaborators, physicians from the respiratory world. So we have a very robust taxonomy, specifically talking about respiratory adverse events and symptoms. So we had to do some really minor modifications, but it really helped us to glean insights regarding the COVID-19 spread in the context of the vaping community. So they discussed a bunch of different things, such as symptoms, knowledge gaps and misinformation, and drivers of basically public discourse. And actually, throughout the process, what we were able to see that there were four archetypes, I would say, of social writers. So the first one was more self-reporting of symptoms and geolocations. So that was really something interesting, because the type of things that you can glean from such posts is really priceless. Some users, including verified COVID-19 patients, also shared how being ill felt, the locations they were visited the days before experiencing the symptoms. So you can really also try and build a timeline of the disease onset in a very bottom-up approach. The other archetype that we saw was vaping-specific health implications. So again, the coverage was focused on the vaping community, so a lot of relevant discussions that are focused on topics such as outcomes of COVID-19 for people who smoke or vape. At this moment, of course, we don't have the control group, just the non-vaping community to compare with, but this is something that we intend to build very soon. I'll talk about it later on. The third group was conspiracy theories and disbelief. And I think this is something very interesting and important when you think about means of controlling information and data. And we know this is a huge problem. So many post writers shared fake or biased news, conspiracy theories that were not really grounded in data. They rapidly gained momentum. That was crazy to see those spike really fast over social media. And some of these writers expressed their disbelief in official authorities based on reports and action that were conducted during the E-Valley outbreak and later turned to be excessive or wrong. So there's also these questions of distrust. And, you know, there's a huge piece that came out this last week, in New York Times, that specifically talk about the spread of conspiracy theories. And this is a great tool to explore that. And sometimes they would use experts who would share some data that might seem true and relevant to the layman. But that's kind of the way that they were able to influence public opinion. And when you try to think about reverse engineer that, if you have access to such knowledge, you can really help to combat that and spread facts, make sure you're relying on reliable sources, and so on and so forth.
The pandemic really came home to us in the foundation very clearly when Yuqin Xu, one of our staff members and our data analytics scientist, had visited Wuhan to visit her family for the Lunar New Year. She luckily was one of the last people to be able to jump onto a plane before the boycott and the close down of people coming from China was imposed from the US. She describes her experiences in this podcast and draws home to us the fact that the public health measures that the Chinese government implemented in that early phase of the pandemic, way back in January and February, were successful and limited the number of cases across China to about 85,000 and about 6,900 deaths. Compare that to what happened in the U.S.
Here's Yuchen Xu from episode 4. Original air date was April 9th. And at this time, the World Health Organization was reporting that there were 395,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. and just over 12,700 deaths.
It was like, I got the news that the U.S. was going to issue the travel ban on February 2nd, and I was supposed to be back on 5th, and once I got the news, I just booked the ticket right away and packed all my stuff within 3 hours and just left home. It was really a significant contrast comparing the situation I left China and entered U.S. We chose to take the train to the airport because if we drive, there would be a lot of like temperature tests on the way. And it would take like 7 hours or even longer to drive to Xi'an Airport, which used to take about like 3 to 4 hours. So we chose the public transportation. Everyone was wearing masks, and I've been taking temperature for like about 4 to 5 times until I finally got the departure gate. And everyone was wearing masks all the way on the plane. And after I got JFK, I was a bit surprised. No one was measuring the temperature. But since I had Wuhan history, I was asked separately by the CDC staff to fill in a form and answer some questions to make sure that I'm healthy. And then they just let me go. And after I got home, I started the 14-day self-quarantine again. I remember, like, just after I left, the situation was getting severe, and the government issued the notice regarding delayed return to work and school, and the local government kept reminding everyone to stay at home through text messages, and also, like, teach everybody to when to wear the mask, how to use it and dispose of it properly. And the public transportation within my city suspended, like the bus, the taxis. And before entering any public locations like the pharmacy, supermarket, people would be measured their temperature at the entrance. And at that time, my families and I, we kept following the news from the local health commission every day, because they tracked and monitored each new confirmed patient within our province. And the public would know their age, medical history, travel history, and contact history. So overall, the government tried their best to get all of us informed. And until late February, the whole epidemic situation in China was under control. And people, like, I remember, it's like, late February, people started to get back to work, but they were still requested for a 14-day self-quarantine if they were from another city. And I just heard from my cousin, the local school at my hometown will be open next Monday, and the students will, like, take the line to enter the campus and have the infrared face scan to test their temperature. And my uncle in Beijing said now, like, the whole city is even more cautious and strict on the epidemic control and prevention, just in order to curb any imported cases. So now, like, everything seems turning to a new page, but still a lot of uncertainties, so it's not the time to relax or celebrate.
One of our colleagues, Ricardo Pelosa, from Catania, on the island of Sicily in Italy, was very aware of the fact that across northern Italy, during the early part of the pandemic, there was a horrific toll being taken on the hospitals, and that there also had been government interventions leading to a ban on vape and smoke shops. He was very aware, being a leader in the field of smoking cessation, of what that would do for people in terms of anxiety and stress. And in the podcast, you will hear about his response to try and show that a more public health oriented approach was taken to address the needs of smokers during the height of the pandemic.
Here's Professor Ricardo Peloso from our very first episode. Original air date was April 1st, and at this time, all the foundation staff began working remotely, and as I said at the beginning of the podcast, the World Health Organization was reporting that there were over 163,000 cases of COVID-19 and just under 3,000 deaths.
Smokers-wise, I think they haven't been very much affected, to be honest, because the initial decree stated that essential business were staying open, and included in the list of essential business there were tobacconists. When I read the decree, I thought, and what about the vapors? What about all these smokers smoking in their homes and exposing innocent bystanders to the passive smoking? So I had some very quick and discussions with the independent electronic cigarette industry, and we sketched a plea to the government to in order to have also vape shops staying open at the same time. And quite surprisingly, the government has been receptive of this plea, and probably this is in a way recognition that they understand the value of these new technologies in terms of reducing the harm from smoke.
Some countries, South Africa and India in particular, introduced complete bans on the sale of cigarettes. In the case of South Africa, this extended to alcohol and a wide range of other products. The ban was allegedly introduced to try and reduce the transmission of the virus among people who would be using and sharing cigarettes. The reality, though, was that it played out in ways that have had long-term consequences for the country in terms of the growth of illicit trade, the loss of masses of tax revenue, and the creation of a massive criminal enterprise that is going to be very tough to overcome. Tony Leon gives his account of the reality of how this played out in South Africa.
Skipping forward a bit, here's South African politician Tony Leon from episode 27. Original air date was September 4th, and at this time, South Africa had only recently lifted the tobacco and alcohol ban. In the USA, there were 6.2 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and just under 188,000 deaths.
University of Cape Town Research Unit on the Economics of Excisable Products, a bit of a mouthful, but they actually look at the tax implications of such policies. They actually did a very wide-ranging survey, and they found that 93% of people who were smoking before the lockdown or the prohibition continued to smoke during the lockdown. The question was, they couldn't buy what we call, you know, regular name brand legal cigarettes, so they bought them illicitly, and one of the studies found that there was a 457% markup on such illicit brands compared to the regular brands. But of course, quite aside from the constitutionality of that, and it was never finally resolved in court because the ban was lifted, as you know, some 2.5 weeks ago on the 18th of August, what we found, and this was not in dispute, other matters were, that the fiscus or the revenue service were losing 36 million rand every single day of that ban. That meant 1.5 billion rand a month, or something like 6.5 billion rand in lost tax revenues for the 4.5 month prohibition period. Now, if you add those lost revenues together with the much greater lost revenues on the alcohol front, which was also banned for quite a lot of the same period, that total loss to the fiscus or the tax authority was greater than the $4.5 billion US dollar loan, emergency loan, rapid finance instrument that South Africa received from the IMF to tide it over during COVID-19 and the pandemic. So the thing was crazy at a macro economic level. At a microeconomic level, it was devastating for a range of producers, workers, and so on. So, and it wasn't scientific, because you would know far better than me that there is no science behind saying that smokers are more susceptible to coronavirus than non-smokers. In fact, and I know it's very early days, we've got to apply a lot of caution to this. The evidence I've seen actually suggests the reverse. I don't want to say one should start smoking to avoid getting COVID-19, but certainly on the statistics available, smokers are at the very least no more likely to contract coronavirus than non-smokers, and arguably less so. So there was no science, and what this ban did was point to another serious problem which really undermined the credibility of Cyril Ramaphosa, and who's the president, and the South African government. You know, I've been in South Africa, obviously, for the whole period of lockdown, and as you mentioned in the intro, I was the head of the opposition to this government. But when Ramaphosa announced in his first televised address that there was going to be a full, really hard lockdown on the 26th of March, his public approval rating soared in the stratosphere, because people wanted decisive action. They were feeling very panic-stricken, as you would know, in the States and elsewhere, as people were earlier this year. And here was a president stepping up to the plate and doing something decisive, and then adding that we will be guided by the science of this. It quickly became apparent, with the cigarette ban particularly, that there was no science behind it. And in fact, three of the foremost medical advisors on the so-called MAC, which is a Ministerial Advisory Committee, had not in any manner, shape, or form, and they were public health experts, been behind the ban or had been given the reasons for the ban. That was the extraordinary thing. And one of them, Professor Francois Venter, in relation to the fact that the government announced that taxis could operate at full capacity across wherever, which were probably the biggest single petri dish of infection and people traveling or being in close quarters with each other, said it was a complete mystery how government reached its decisions, because it was more about politics than science. So, you know, on many levels, for people, and I, you know, a lot of people in my circle don't smoke at all, in fact, are very antithetical to cigarettes, were outraged by the ban, because to them, quite aside from all these dire numbers for the fiscus I've mentioned, Derek, there was a feeling that this is a fundamental invasion by the state into matters which really citizens should exercise their choices.
During the pandemic, it became very aware to us in the foundation that there were going to be widespread effects on how people address their smoking behavior. And with that in mind, we commissioned a study in five countries to look at how people who smoked and used tobacco products were coping. The results are available at our website. The key findings, I believe, were that a majority of smokers wanted to use the chance of being under a pandemic to quit, but they weren't given the tools, the support, or the knowledge to be able to succeed. And the result is that as they emerge from the pandemic, the smoking rates will be virtually the same, and in some cases may very well have been increased. A great missed opportunity by the public health authorities to take action. The nexus between smoking and COVID-19 was one that led many to ask us, what do you believe is the impact of smoking on COVID-19? Is it going to increase or reduce your risk of disease? Our early comments from March were really based on the first principles of what we understood about the use of smoking and viral diseases like influenza and even conditions like tuberculosis, where evidence had shown over decades that the heavier you smoke, the greater your risk of the severity of infectious diseases, a wide range of respiratory conditions, and tuberculosis. That was what we believed would happen with COVID-19. We were increasingly surprised as result after result started coming out of hospitals, first in China, then in Italy, then in Israel, then in the US, then in the UK, suggesting, in fact, that smokers may in some way be protected if they were actively using cigarettes, probably due to nicotine. Konstantinos provides us with some of the insights into both the mechanisms and the evolving research and the science.
This is senior researcher Konstantinos Ferrosalinos from episode 20. Original air date was June 29th. Konstantinos had just released his comparative research findings on the relationship between COVID-19 and smokers. You can read the paper available on our podcast page. And at this time in the U.S., there were 2.6 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and just over 127,000 deaths.
Yes, it's absolutely true. We were expecting, considering that COVID-19 is a respiratory disease, an infectious respiratory disease, we were expecting both increased susceptibility and increased severity among smokers. But as you correctly mentioned, the original data from case series, retrospective observational case series from China, not the best of data in terms of quality, but, it's a pandemic. There is an urgency to have some data, so we need to analyze everything we have. The first case series were showing an unexpectedly low prevalence of smoking among hospitalized cases. And I emphasize that these studies were coming from China because we know very well that smoking prevalence is pretty high in China, particularly in males. Approximately 50% of males smoke in China. So we would have expected smokers to be overrepresented among hospitalized patients, but no, we are seeing a substantial underrepresentation of smokers. So I started gathering the data in early March, and over time we came out to up to 30 studies being analyzed now. There is a paper which is right now in press where we are consistently seeing that smokers are underrepresented among hospitalized patients. In the meantime, there are more data from other countries which are also showing the same. I can mention data from the UK, from France, from Israel. Some of the data also suggest lower susceptibility for infected with SARS-CoV-2. It is fascinating. We have developed a hypothesis on why this is happening. We are working on this hypothesis, and we need to look for more data on that. So it's still a hypothesis. We are still working on that. We cannot, of course, and I think we both need to be clear on that, we cannot recommend to anyone to initiate or to continue to smoke. Yeah. We don't think, I strongly believe that it's not smoking that causes these potential effects, but a component in smoking, particularly nicotine. So we are looking on this data in order to look at potential therapeutic effects and therapeutic value for nicotine in the form of medications.
The complex relationship between smoking and COVID-19 remains under review. The foundation issued a number of RFPs to have scientists study this in greater depth, both from the epidemiological point of view, as well as from the mechanistic point of view. Over the last couple of months, a number of randomized trials have started in France, where the use of the nicotine patch is being incorporated into hospitals to test whether it's able to reduce the severity and the complications of COVID-19. I would say that while our first statement was very emphatic that smoking would increase the risk, I think now we have to moderate that to say that probably nicotine may be playing an effect in reducing the severity among the active smokers. Former smokers, however, appear to remain at, as expected, higher risks than the general non-smoking population, probably because of the damage that has already been done to their lungs and their cardiovascular system. But this is a space where science surprises, and during a pandemic, one often learns things that were never possible to study because of the severity of the condition. Recommendations to smokers about what they should or could be using usually starts off with nicotine replacement therapy, a range of pharmaceutical and medicated programs, often advice given through apps or online services. But most of those have really been adapted primarily to the developed world. The pricing, the affordability, the cultural acceptability is really adapted for those people living in low middle income countries where 80% of tobacco users reside. The ability to transform and change and adapt programs to low middle income countries is something that really has not attracted sufficient attention. George Bostock discusses substantial work they've done both at the qualitative and the quantitative level to ensure that we find better ways to improve access among low middle income country populations to the best that cessation and harm reduction has.
Here's George Bostock from Cambridge Design Partnership. Original air date was June 3rd, and at this time in the U.S., there were 1.9 million cases of COVID-19 and about 110,000 deaths.
From the point of view of access, yeah, I mean, there was stark differences in the countries that we went to. For instance, in Russia, we saw, the heat not burn reduced risk product market kind of booming in the cities, perhaps less so outside the cities, but in Moscow there was a huge kind of boom for products there, and products were available in the physical sense. That's not to say that everyone could afford them, but they were being made affordable through marketing approaches in terms of financing and so on. If I then kind of go across to some of the other countries, and thinking perhaps more kind of e-cigarettes. In Indonesia, there were many e-cigarettes and vape stores, so products were available there, but completely on a different scale to cigarettes. So cigarettes you can buy at almost every corner stand. Like I can almost guarantee that you wouldn't have to walk more than 100 meters in India or Indonesia and probably China to be able to buy a pack of cigarettes. So whilst we were driving around and wandering around, we did come across vape stores. Yeah, you're talking about kind of a dozen in a city as opposed to probably thousands and thousands of individual retailers for cigarettes. So the ubiquity of cigarettes is something that RRP currently has to contend with. The reason why perhaps why you're not seeing more perhaps vape stores and outlets is twofold. Perhaps just the demand isn't there yet, but really it's probably a kind of a cost issue. There's a much bigger upfront cost associated with e-cigarettes and vapes. That's not to say that cost stays high throughout use. If you're able to buy a device, the consumables are can be affordable. But that's something that definitely came into it. And then there's also the regulatory side as well. So whilst we're actually in the field, both China and India introduced bans in this space. So China put in a ban on kind of internet sales for RRP and e-cigarette products. India put in an outright state, a kind of federal level ban for e-cigarettes. So obviously that has its own role to play in terms of actually reducing access.
I think the one thing which is important always to remind listeners of that the single biggest effect that has, of course, is it leaves the status quo. In other words, the combustible cigarette as the norm in the market.
Yeah, for sure. And you've got to think of this thing in the eyes of the consumer. And I'll build on this in a second. In the eyes of the consumer, you've got to think of this as cigarettes are kind of the competitors to an RRP device for a smoker. If I'm a smoker, my incumbent product is cigarettes, and someone's trying to convince me to move across to an RRP device because it's arguably safer for me. And I've got to make a decision between the two, which one's better for me overall. And convenience is just going to be one of those things. Convenience, finance, there's a whole range of attributes that I will be judging consciously or unconsciously in making that decision.
While there are important gaps in science capacity in low middle income countries that impede progress for cessation and harm reduction, there is also a very, very well organized, heavily funded effort through the Bloomberg Philanthropies to ensure that there are bans on harm reduction products introduced into low middle income countries. These bans, of course, have been taken up by a number of governments and directly impede the ability of smokers who may want to switch to a lower risk or substantially lower risk product without stopping the use of nicotine completely. One needs to remember that the evidence also has shown that e-cigarette use is now the commonest route in most European countries to complete cessation, outstripping nicotine replacement therapy and other medicated uses. Samrat, from a major NGO working with users across the world, discusses the implications and the impact of this call to ban by a US philanthropy and how it's having a negative effect both on policy in developing countries and on the user base who want to and want to seek out healthier solutions.
This is Samrat Chowdhury, the president of the International Network of Nicotine Consumer Organizations, or INCO for short. Original air date was June 27th, and at this time in the U.S., there were 2.6 million cases of COVID-19 and 149,000 deaths.
It's surprising to note that every single anti-vaping or anti-THR advocate or organization in India is connected to one funding source. And that same funding source also directly funds government initiatives and state initiatives in health, and that gives them a lot of influence. But that, I think, is one aspect of it. There's also the role of WHO, and it's speaking in folk tongues, where while it accepts the role of harm reduction in Western nations, it advocates for bans in developing nations. In fact, after India's ban, the Southeast Asian arm of WHO congratulated India for its ban. There's also the aspect of the tobacco industry, in which the Indian government actively participates and owns a major share in the country's tobacco monopoly. And as you noted, the stock prices, tobacco stock prices, shot up on the news of the ban. So I think these factors came together, created a perfect storm, and the government just fell for it. I think the population that benefits the most from harm reduction measures are people in the lower income bracket, because for them, prevention is the key, for which I think there is a little bit of reimagining that is required to market or see these products as marketed towards or made for people living in low income countries and belonging to low income groups. So for example, e-cigarettes, they are the market usually now at the moment is middle and upper income groups, but it is quite possible to also make these products for people living in LMICs.
Yeah, and I look at snus naively and then look at the products on the Indian market, from gutkha and pan masala and a range of products causing very high levels of oral cancer, whereas we know snus would dramatically cut those to almost zero. What is impeding a product like snus being developed for the Indian market to displace many of the other smokeless products?
One, I think, is awareness. You know, tobacco harm reduction or the harm reduction potential of snus is not... it's understood among Indian academicians also, but it's not gained enough momentum to be considered from a policy perspective. When it comes to making these products, it is quite possible to make them in India. It's because India is a large producer of tobacco crop. It's also, you know, and smokeless tobacco use is quite prevalent in India. In fact, it's a much bigger pie of tobacco use than smoking. And 350,000 people die from SLT use or every year. So the problem is big enough to look at it seriously. Snus, of course, has great potential in the Indian context. It can be made locally. It can be made from local tobacco, of which there's already a surplus. It just requires the political will.
During the pandemic, all was not gloom and doom with regard to progress on harm reduction. Very importantly, the evidence was getting stronger about some of the tried and tested methods, starting with snus, which is a particularly Swedish-based smokeless product. And one of the people who did most of the work on this, going back many decades, Carl Fagerstrom, talks about both the science, the benefit, and what he's learnt about the application and value of snus as a means of moving people out of combustible cigarettes and toxic tobacco products into something that does not give them those excess risks. Importantly, just before doing the interview, the Food and Drug Administration issued one of their very first directives indicating that the science, in their view, showed that snus constituted a lower risk, lower exposure product compared to combustibles, and that it would indeed be a sensible switch for those using combustibles to switch completely to a snus product if they wanted to lower their risk. This was the first of two major announcements by the FDA during 2020. The second was with regard to the IQOS product of PMI, making a similar statement around it having a lower exposure, substantially lower exposure, compared to a combustible cigarette.
Here's Carl Fagerström out of Sweden. Original air date was October 8th. And at this time, there were 7.6 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. and about 213,000 deaths.
I mean, I was very happy, as many others, to see that the FDA could recognize Swedish snus as a less harmful product. But that doesn't make the trick. I mean, we do know that also physicians in a country where you think physicians are more enlightened than many other countries in the U.S., a large majority still believe that nicotine, and snus contains nicotine, of course, is causing not only cancer but cardiovascular disease and even COPD, how the mechanisms would be possible for that. So I think the ramifications depend on what FDA or other agencies in the U.S. Are going to do in terms of speaking the truth. It's also, of course, partly in the hands of the producer, in this case Swedish Match, and to some extent you and myself and other scientists in the field here. Very recently, just a few days ago, we completed to look at tobacco-related morbidity in Sweden with global burden for disease data. And we found the very same, if not a little bit more clearer than before, since snus have been used for longer and smoking has gone down in Sweden. So we, from the global report on diseases, we have very strong data that Sweden is not even close to the second best in the European Union, but clearly an outlier, both in cardiovascular cancer, COPD, mouth, oral cancer, larynx cancer, etc., etc. So the data is here. They are very clear.
The global report on tobacco harm reduction has now moved into its second edition. Harry Shapiro pulls together the evidence in this extraordinary report that really documents progress on the one hand. The examples I've already commented on, the FDA decisions on snus and IQOS, hopefully soon to be followed by support for a wide range of e-cigarettes. The United Kingdom's Cochrane decisions on the power of e-cigarettes as a means of quitting, being just some of the evidence that is cited. But the report also goes into a great deal of detail about what is thwarting and hampering progress, particularly for low middle income countries.
This is Harry Shapiro, the director of DrugWise and the lead writer and editor of the Global State of Tobacco Harm Reduction's recent report titled Burning Issues. The report will be available on our podcast page. Original air date for this episode was November 16th, and at this time in the U.S., there were almost 11 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and just over 247,000 deaths.
So very roughly, 68 million, 70-odd million people using vaping products, around 20 million people using heated tobacco products, and around 10 million people using snus, oral tobacco product. So that's pretty much where it kind of breaks down and is in fact higher than some of the market S projections of where we would be by 2021. I mean, the highest figure I can remember seeing was something in the region of 50 million.
Well, on our calculation, we probably double that. So that's actually extremely encouraging. Although it has to be set against, of course, the actual number of smokers that there still are, and that figure is something in the region of 1.1 billion. So we are a long way from any kind of tipping point.
You know, I said that the other thing that strikes me is that over the last year, we've had a lot of interesting stuff coming out of the FDA, UK, Cochrane. So would you say that the evidence on the benefit side is getting stronger compared to the report 2 years ago?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think the evidence that is certainly consistent. We've got more studies now showing, for example, that people using e-cigarettes to move away from smoking cigarettes is more effective than people who've been using nicotine replacement therapy. We've got, probably most significantly, we've got the FDA now allowing the promotion of heated tobacco product and snus as being healthier than using cigarettes. And the important point about that, I think, is that they based their findings and their approval on industry science. An awful lot of industry science, a staggering amount of data was provided to the FDA for that. Now, the narrative, the external narrative on all of this so far has been you can't trust what the industry says, which is, you know, one of the major obstacles to faster progress, of course. But clearly the FDA have taken a different line. I mean, they're saying, you know, it all has to be monitored and we have to keep our eye on everything, and that's absolutely fine. But that's an important step forward.
There were a number of podcasts during the year that really addressed gaps in science, in policy, in action. And I believe represent areas where in 2021, we as a foundation and generally as a community hope to see greater and accelerated change. Let me highlight three which are well described and spoken about in the associated podcast. The first is the importance of the voice of doctors and their leadership in science. During the pandemic, we have seen the importance of authoritative figures. For the US, Dr. Fauci will go down as the one icon who really stood up throughout the pandemic and gave sound advice. But we've known that for the area of smoking, it's also been essential to have doctors provide leadership. The 1960s really saw the Surgeon General report and the Royal College of Physicians report led by doctors who first had to address their own smoking behavior before addressing it in their patients and then becoming advocates for public policy. We haven't seen that happen to the extent we hope it would for low-middle-income countries. Pooja describes in her podcast the importance of strengthening that voice and bringing it to the fore, something I hope that we'll see accelerate in 2021.
Jumping back here a little, here's Dr. Pooja Padwadan from episode 9. Original air date was April 29th, and at this time, the U.S. had just hit 1 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 63,000 deaths.
Yeah, I think I'm very fortunate that I get to work in a country like UK, as you rightly said, which is at the forefront of global smoking cessation and is trying to implement really good policies. But as I have mentioned before, in practice, things are not changing, and that's because the influencers who actually deal with a lot of these smokers in day-to-day life are not aware of tobacco harm reduction, what are the effects of nicotine, how nicotine is very, very different than smoking cigarettes, and how we can actually help these smokers using the harm reduction principle. So what I think the main learning from this, when we are actually using this knowledge for the rest of the world, would be that policies in UK, we can see, are supporting safer nicotine use to quit smoking. but practice is not changing. We are seeing the number of quit rates plateauing. And that is when we need to understand how important it is to change the mindset of the influencers. Because at the end of the day, when media stories are so confusing and people are getting mixed messages, they rely on influencers like healthcare professionals to give them the final guidance, the final verdict about safety of certain products. And if those people are confused themselves, they can't really help these smokers to quit smoking using these products. So I think I'll give you an example maybe. Recently, we conducted some focus group discussions on some vapors who have quit smoking successfully using electronic cigarettes. And I was really surprised. It was insightful to talk to them because even after quitting smoking and feeling good about it, they were not sure how safe actually the electronic cigarettes are. And it just felt like they would tip back to smoking at any point. And that was worrying to me because, as we know, in smoking, relapse is such a big risk.
During the year, the foundation released the first tobacco transformation index report, which ranks companies in terms of their progress to move out of combustibles and into reduced risk products. Mike Cummings makes important comments about how important this index is and how it fosters competition between the companies that may be a powerful complementary way of achieving an end to smoking, complementing the work of governments and the WHO Framework Convention. In 2021, we hope that we'll see acceleration both of the trends as well as an acceleration of the quality of the science that is underpinning the change within industry.
Here's Michael Cummings. Michael frequently appears as an expert witness in legal proceedings against cigarette manufacturers. Derek and Michael spoke in episode 32. Original air date was October 30th, and at this time there were 9 million cases of COVID-19 in the U.S. and just over 230,000 deaths.
I've become increasingly convinced that the key group to target with what would move the market are investors. As long as the investors and the money stays with cigarettes, we're not going to change very much. But when the investors begin to see the handwriting on the wall and really dig down into where the money's going to be 5 and 10 years from now, I don't think it's going to be in the combustible cigarette business. In fact, you can already see the money flowing away from that, even though the companies quarter to quarter look amazingly profitable. Their overall ability to maintain that over 5, 10, 20 years is going to be severely limited. And I've heard from the lawyers. They've asked me this question. They said, well, Dr. Cummings, what would happen if we got out of the cigarette business? Wouldn't somebody else just come in to fill in the niche? And I said, well, that's possible and maybe even very likely. But you wouldn't be sitting here defending your client because they wouldn't have the liability that they should own that keeps the price up. I mean, if that company's actually had to pay the price for what cigarettes really cost governments and humanity, they would be enormously expensive. And as we started off, price makes a difference. And we've been playing around at the edges on the real price of cigarettes around taxation and so on. Even in places like Australia where we say, oh, they've got the highest taxes, and certainly it's had a big impact on depressing cigarette sales. We should be, charging $100 a pack of cigarettes.
2020, many people characterize as having a twin epidemic of infodemic, misinformation, fake news, incorrect statements, deliberately subversive statements that confuse people with regard to the causes and impact of COVID-19, the benefits of vaccination, the use of masks, and in fact, all aspects of the pandemic. Well, many of those very similar ideas apply to what we've seen in the efforts to accelerate harm reduction. We've seen people confused and believing that nicotine causes cancer, which it does not, and because of that, are more likely to continue with a combustible cigarette than move towards an e-cigarette, an IQOS, a snus, or even use nicotine patches and gums. Don Kenkel from Cornell discusses the importance of tackling misinformation and as something that really underpins the ability to have sensible policies and to have users and consumers understand what is in their own best interest.
This is economist Donald Kenkel from Cornell University, episode 26. Original air date was August 25th. During this time, there were 5.8 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 and just over 178,000 deaths in the U.S.
We started running online surveys that ask people what they thought about the relative harms of e-cigarettes compared to cigarettes were. Because there had been a bunch of these surveys done previously before the EVALI outbreak over the past 5 or 10 years. And over time, more and more, there's a gradual increase in how many people said that they thought e-cigarettes were actually more harmful than cigarettes, even though the best evidence is out there that e-cigarettes are much less harmful. A slightly growing proportion started saying, well, we think actually e-cigarettes are worse. And with the EVALI outbreak, that jumped up way off trend. And so in our online surveys, we saw the fraction of people who thought that e-cigarettes are actually more harmful doubling compared to what we would have expected from the regular trend. So it went up from like 15% to 30% of people polled were saying, we believe that vaping is either more or much more harmful than smoking. And there were a couple of other things that were really intriguing about that. In some of the versions of the survey, we describe the e-cigarettes as possibly containing THC to see if that was changing how people's answered. And we ask another question later on in another survey about THC. And most of the public did not seem to perceive that THC was the problem. The message they were getting was that vaping is the problem. I mean, it's right there in the name, e-cigarette or vaping associated lung injuries. And that led people to think that vaping was the problem, all vaping, not just the THC products. And the other thing that was very interesting we noticed was that, you know, the outbreak happened last September, and we started surveys right then, but we continued them through May of this year. And the perceptions did not go back to where they were before. So it's like they've permanently ratcheted up their beliefs about how harmful e-cigarettes are. This outbreak has scared some people away from e-cigarettes at least for a year, almost a year now.
Finally, with regard to looking forward into 2021, one point that came through very clearly by looking at the polls we carried out during the year was the sense that smokers have that their rights are not being considered. Empathy is not being shown to them. Ethan Nadelman, who led a lot of the work on the decriminalization of drug use, as well as on the HIV/AIDS epidemic, has really spent his career steeped in the value of harm reduction to address complex health and social issues, and was naturally drawn into the issue of tobacco control and the huge yawning gap that existed in the application of harm reduction to tobacco, and the link that that has to respecting human rights. His podcast, I believe, really is something that we need to be thinking of working on beyond 2020.
We aired Ethan Nadelman's podcast early on in the pandemic. It was April 24th, and at that time, there were just under 913,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the U.S., and just over 54,000 deaths. At the time I'm speaking right now, December 15th, Johns Hopkins is reporting 16.7 million cases and over 300,000 deaths in the U.S., with more and more each day.
For me, what became apparent was that there was a core principle involved here. And the core principle was that nobody but nobody deserves to be punished or discriminated against or amongst based solely upon the things we put into our body, right? That there is no basis for discriminating between somebody who is a responsible alcohol user or a nicotine user and somebody who uses cocaine or heroin or psychedelics or whatever. And there's no basis for saying to imagine a mother who, God forbid, has two kids addicted, one to heroin and one to booze. What is the moral basis or scientific basis or health basis for saying to that parent, well, kid A, who's addicted to booze, we're going to treat one way, and kid B, who's addicted to heroin, which most physicians would tell you is in many respects less dangerous to be addicted to than the alcohol, we're going to treat with that person as fundamentally a criminal. So is that fundamental principle of non-discrimination and of not punishing people based on what they put in their body, that's always been the underlying driving sort of ethical, moral force behind my work, even if most people don't get it, because we're so bought into the broader cultural thing that's virtually global, that these drugs are somehow okay and the other ones are not. And I think what happens is that there are some people in the public health field who fail to distinguish between a virus, a pandemic, a plague, where there's no demand whatsoever among people. There's no demand for COVID-19. There's no demand for bubonic plague or for things like that. Conversely, when it comes to e-cigarettes or nicotine or cannabis or opioids, there is in fact a demand. There's a demand among people who find it a beneficial thing in their lives, even if ultimately their calculations are mistaken. There's a demand among people who are dependent or addicted to it, but who, can't stop and should not be treated as criminals. And understand that fundamental distinction between public health policies dealing with a threat that is not demand-driven, as opposed to a threat that is demand-driven, is, I think, fundamental to understanding harm reduction. And I think it's the failure of key public health authorities to make that distinction that results in them advocating for policies that deprive people of their human rights, that diminish them as human beings, and that ultimately can generate vast black markets with all of the sorts of attendant harms we've seen with the global war on drugs.
Let me give some final thoughts as we close out the year. The pandemic really has been a year of despair. It ends with hope, with a vaccine on the horizon. But I think the lessons of the year really apply both to how we manage large-scale public health problems like COVID-19, as well as smoking. I mentioned that Yuchen left China on one of the last planes that were able to come to the US. Over the last couple of weeks, I've gone back to her to say, well, maybe that wasn't a great idea, that if she'd stayed in China, she would have actually seen the end of an epidemic and for the last 6 months lived in a normal society with masks, social distancing, and many of the measures which we are still taking in the US no longer have to be taken, because the case numbers have dropped to zero for many, many, many months. Why did it work in China and not in the US? How is it possible that there were 85,000 cases and no more in China, a country with over a billion people, and yet in the US we are closing in on 14 million cases and 300,000 deaths? Clearly there's been a massive failure, not just of the top of the government, but of public health itself, to send clear messages out about the value of some of the most powerful harm reduction tools that applied so well in China and countries that succeeded. Masks very early on, physical distancing very early on, contact tracing very early on, repeatedly, and done with a national perspective, none of which happened in the US, and we're suffering the consequences. The lesson for harm reduction as it applies now to tobacco control are all too clear. Many in public health do not like the notion of harm reduction when it comes to tobacco, yet it will save lives. We know that people who switch from something that is burning, a combustible product, or a toxic smokeless product, will substantially lower their risks. Surely what one lesson we have coming out of 2020 is a greater value of the sanctity of every human life, a greater understanding and belief in the need to express empathy to people about the choices they make, but always guided by the central view that if we do things right, we can actually prevent the preventable. And tobacco going into the pandemic was the largest preventable cause of death and disease. It remains the largest preventable cause of death and disease as we start emerging from the pandemic. Let's hope that when the world is vaccinated, we will actually return to actually tackle that as what is the gravest pandemic facing many people around the world.